The date is August 14th, 1987, and we're watching The Monster Squad. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Welcome to our second spooky Halloween edition of I Used to Like This One, this show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. I'm your host, Sean Wells, and with me is my co-host...
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
And joining us this week for our special Halloween episode, we have author of a book called The 13th Hour and host of The 13th Hour podcast, Josh Blum. Josh, how's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for having me here.
Oh, well, we're excited to have you. So with Monster Squad, because I know your book is kind of fantasy driven, this is kind of the closest that I could find to complement that. What is your experience with the Monster Squad, and because you're into fantasy, what's your horror fantasy life like?
Yeah, so I've actually never actually seen this movie before you mentioned it. I don't even think I've heard of it, but it was awesome. I loved it actually from the very first frame when they mentioned, like, they blew it.
The scroll in the beginning.
It's a totally the sort of thing I probably would have loved, you know, as a kid. There's plenty of other films. I mean, I grew up in the 80s and watched lots of other, you know, these films, a number of the ones that you guys had done. And that's, of course, how I find your podcast. And I talk about them on my own show.
Yeah.
So no experience, but really liked it. In terms of my own experience with horror kind of stuff.
Because you in your writing, you deal with fairies and elves. Like, I haven't had a chance to read more than a few chapters of your first book. So I'm just wondering, vampires make an appearance or anything like that? Horror monsters.
Yeah, I guess just like a quick synopsis, I guess, of this. Like, when I was a kid, this was the time of like Dungeons and Dragons and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
there was plenty of imagery around, and I always really wanted to like fantasy novels and that kind of stuff, but I had zero success actually reading any of them or actually understanding them. And so anyway, I wrote this book, there's a couple of them, but I wrote something that I would have wanted to read when I was a kid.
Okay.
And it's, I would say, like, kind of like a fairy tale fantasy story, but I think more than just fantasy, it's probably more like, I would say, 80s fantasy movies and sci-fi movies, plus some like teen movies from the 80s, kind of in book form.
Yeah.
And because I'd always wanted to like these different novels, but had, you know, very little success kind of understanding them. I always wanted to like things like Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that, but I didn't really understand what that was until much, much later. And when I actually understood, someone actually told me what it was, I was actually quite disappointed, but I just had no clue. I thought it was like a big video game or something like that.
Yeah. See, I mean, I have to agree with you. Something like Lord of the Rings is a hard read. And that's something that I have to admit, I've never fully read to this date either. The Hobbit is one that I've read, but Lord of the Rings, I can't get through it. It's too hard.
Yeah, I don't know. This is like, I think it's really hard for like folks maybe today to who've grown up in a time when there's the internet and readier access to information, mm-hmm. to kind of like wrap their heads around this. But like, I had no one to tell me like, hey, this is a good book and this is one that's like pretty lousy. And I would always pick like, I don't know, just stuff was harder to find, right? So I'd get a copy of something like at a yard sale or something. It would be book like 2 of 5 or something. I was like, it would be awesome because I was like, oh, this is a great cover. And I would read the first page. And first of all, I was probably like, you know, 8, 9 years old or whatever. And like, I don't really understand what any of this means. But I would really want to like it. And I would try a little harder and I would get to chapter 2. And I was like, I still don't really understand what this is about. So I had no one actually to tell me like, hey, you know, maybe you should try like something like The Hobbit, you know, or try one of these other things that actually, you know, you could get into. I just had kind of, I don't know. I never really thought to ask. I could have gone to a library and I never could have, I could have like asked the librarian, but yeah. I did, however, read The NeverEnding Story. So that's the only one I had some success with.
Oh, see, that's something that we mentioned in our episode that we haven't even done. So, okay, well, this week we're looking back at August 1987 when the movies and theaters were Can't Buy Me Love, Who's That Girl, Stakeout, G.I. Joe the Movie, the cartoon one, Masters of the Universe, last week's subject, The Lost Boys, and of course, our movie for today, The Monster Squad, which earned $3.8 million on a $12 million budget, the first non-profitable movie we've covered.
And as always, we are speaking about a movie that came out 33 years ago, so there will be spoilers ahead. If you don't want the movie to be spoiled for you, hit pause now, go watch it, then come back and hear what we have to say.
Alrighty, so the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "The end of the world starts at midnight." Now, I've also noticed as I've been doing this, we have a wonderful website designer, David Sun, who was our guest star on the Mortal Kombat episode. And he manages to find posters to put on our website that don't always have the same tagline. So there are alternate taglines out there for some of these movies. So I did find a backup one on this one, which is, "You know who to call when you have ghosts, but who do you call when you have monsters?"
Yeah, that's the one I saw everywhere.
Yeah, but that may not be the best description. So let's go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
The 60-second synopsis is going to tell you exactly how I feel about this movie.
Uh-oh.
So, The Monster Squad. It's the second-rate Goonies versus your bargain-basement Universal Monster knockoffs. When Sean Crenshaw is given the journal of legendary vampire hunter Abraham Van Helsing, it sets him and his group of monster-loving friends on a collision course with cinema's most famous monsters, led by the evil Count Dracula. Will Sean and the Monster Squad be able to use Van Helsing's diary to find the inexplicably unnamed amulet and use it to cast the monsters into limbo? Or will Dracula, after 100 years of waiting, finally be able to use the amulet to plunge the world into darkness? Let's find out.
So you love the movie. Is that what you're saying? I do want to start by pointing out that Sean is spelt wrong. It's spelt S-E-A-N, and I don't like that. As a lifelong Sean myself, I'll also start off by mentioning here that just 3 days ago, on October 27th, a 2018 documentary about this movie called Wolfman's Got Nards was released for the first time on DVD and Blu-ray. So I'm not sure why there was a delay, but if you love this movie and want a physical copy of the documentary on the cult status of this movie, it's available now. So the documentary will be mentioned a couple more times coming up. For me, this is one of those movies that introduced me to horror. I talked a bit last week with Lost Boys about being the same sort of thing, being kind of a gateway drug of horror movies. Not only was it an introduction to scary movies in general, but it was also my introduction to these iconic movie monsters. I mean, obviously because of things like Scooby-Doo and the Flintstones, I already knew the monsters. I already knew Frankenstein and Dracula and Creature from the Black Lagoon. But for live action monsters, this was the one. So, Colin, we've heard what Josh has to say. What is your experience with Monster Squad before now?
Zero. Absolutely zero experience. Okay. Never heard, like Josh, I'd never heard of this movie before. And, you know, I think it was for the good reason.
Well, and it's one that did terribly in the theaters, but it achieved this cult status after the fact. Okay, let's jump into The Monster Squad. It's directed by Frank Decker, who has 5 director credits. Night of the Creeps, RoboCop 3, Blind Run, and 1 episode of Tales from the Crypt. It's produced by Keith Barish, who was a producer on 9.5 Weeks, Last Action Hero, Running Man, Big Trouble in Little China, The Fugitive, and U.S. Marshals. And it's written by Shane Black, who did The Predator, Lethal Weapon movies, Last Action Hero, Iron Man 3, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And Fred Decker was also a writer. He has more writing credits than his five directing credits. He wrote House 2, the second story, which actually opened in theaters 3 weeks after The Monster Squad, The Predator, and several episodes of Enterprise. And we open on the red scroll of letters over a black background. The general gist is that 100 years ago in Transylvania, Van Helsing and a group of angry villagers tried to kill Dracula. And as Josh said in the beginning, this scroll ends with, "They blew it." One of the best jokes in the movie, I'd have to say. and so as I was watching the credits, I realized that I wasn't recognizing any names at all until about a dozen credits in, when Jason Hervey's name came up, and he's the older brother from Wayne Arnold from The Wonder Years. So I recognized that name.
I recognized literally nobody.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, like, That was when I knew I was in trouble, because I just felt like this movie clearly didn't make anyone's career.
Yeah, I was really hoping it would be one of those movies where I said, "Holy shit, I forgot that they were in this," you know?
A funny thing I did find, though, is that there were, like, some actual famous actors who had cut scenes in this movie. Like, Liam Neeson had a cut scene.
Oh.
Dustin Diamond from Saved by the Bell was in it, and his scene was cut.
Wow. I actually had the opposite experience. I mean, not like a ton of folks that I recognized, because when I saw Shane Black's name, and I was like, "Oh, it's the guy from The Predator who made all those like lewd jokes."
Uh-huh.
And then John Grise, who is Laszlo from Real Genius, have you ever seen that movie? Or for Uncle Nico from Napoleon Dynamite.
Well, yeah, I hate Napoleon Dynamite with fiery passion.
I did recognize Shane Black. Yeah.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen Real Genius, I mean, also from...
Oh, Val Kilmer at his best.
It's from 1984, but that's a good one. But anyway, his credit is, he doesn't even have a credit or a name. He's like Desperate Man. He's like the guy who is the human form of the Wolf Man.
Yeah.
Desperate Man.
So we see a graveyard outside of a spooky castle, and then end up in a tomb under the castle, where we see a bat hanging who ends up turning into Dracula, who is played by Duncan Rager. He has 47 credits. His IMDb profile pic is from a 1980 movie he was in called The Last Days of Pompeii.
He's also Canadian.
Is he Canadian?
He's from Lethbridge.
Oh, Lethbridge.
Alberta boy.
Wow. he was also Zorro in an early 90s Zorro TV series that I didn't know about. I did read that as a teenager, he was a figure skating champion. And he was an Olympic boxing contender, and now he's an artist. I looked at some of his stuff. Some of it looks kind of Picasso influenced. He's got some interesting stuff. And Dracula is surrounded by a bunch of fake looking bats that are flying around, and the cheesiness of them is similar to the Goonies bats that we had a big problem with.
There's also rats on the floor that are obviously not rats. They're armadillos, which is crazy.
but they're big.
They're big, yeah.
we get a bunch of villagers led by Van Helsing, who is played by Jack Gwillem. He has 85 credits. He has some great ones like Patton and Jason and the Argonauts, Lawrence of Arabia, Thunderball. He spent 20 years in the Royal Navy before he was an actor. They're storming the castle armed with torches and crosses and rifles and crossbows loaded with stakes instead of the standard bolts. I even went for the correct terminology there instead of saying arrows. We see the jewel, the amulet, that's going all strobe-like crazy. And we've got a youngish virgin girl reading from a scroll as the castle starts crumbling and corpses come to life and a vortex open and everyone in the room gets sucked into the vortex and, yep, they blew it. So there we go. The words in the beginning did not lie. So then we skip to the present day, where we're at a school in the principal's office, where the principal is lecturing Sean, who is played by Andre Grower, who was in 24 episodes of a show called Mr. President, in a movie called Baby Frankenstein, a whole bunch of TV. But he is also the director, the writer, and the producer of the 2018 documentary I was talking about, Wolfman's Got Nards.
Who else would be?
Yeah, it had to be one of them. And we've got Patrick, who is played by Robbie Keegar. He only had one credit after this, which was Welcome Home, Roxy Carmichael, and 35 episodes of Crazy Like a Fox, with a follow-up movie called Still Crazy Like a Fox, was one of his older credits. They are being told off for drawing monster pictures because the teacher was offended or something by Sean's picture of a spider with a human head. Pictures that they like to hang in their monster club clubhouse. Would either of you have ever been sent to the principal's office for drawing a monster picture?
Maybe if it's like a super bad scenario and it's like monster penises. possible concerns.
Or if they were in kindergarten. So he's telling them off for this, and he's trying to be cool with the kids, you know, trying to speak their lingo. And the principal ends his lecture with, "Science is real, monsters are not." Nice broad strokes on the foreshadowing for this movie. Outside, we end up meeting Horace, who is played by Brent Chalum. He has 8 credits total. He died in 1997 from pneumonia, so he really... he really didn't have much of a chance to have a career. He is being picked on by a couple of bullies. EJ, played by Jason Hervey, as I mentioned earlier, from The Wonder Years, Back to the Future, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And Derek, who is played by Adam Carlo, who was the voice of Donatello in Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze, and a bunch of single TV episodes. These two are picking on Horace because he's the fat kid. He's trying to stand up a little bit, and the response is, "What did you say, faggot?" 5 minutes into the movie, and we're already using some very problematic language. They also drop an asshole in there, too.
They also talk about, like, when Sean and, what's the other kid's name?
Patrick.
They're leaving. They say something about, like, "Are you afraid of the homos?" And the there's something
to that. Yeah, homo gets said in there at one point, too. So, as we already discussed to length in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, our third episode, if you want to go back and listen to this, this kind of language is really not acceptable anymore. So it's worth pointing out, but I'm not going to dwell on it because we know it's wrong, and unfortunately it's part of our history. But I did also want to bring up an update from Bill and Ted. I've seen the new one, hilarious. But as we expected, they didn't acknowledge the mistakes of the past. However, since then, it's been announced that the original Bill and Ted movies will now have a disclaimer attached to it that states, "This film reflects historical attitudes which audiences might find outdated or offensive." So I shared a link to this article on our social medias back at the beginning of October because I like to think we were responsible for this change happening because we have that much power here at I Used to Like This One. I'm not a fan of censorship because it's something that Disney does quite frequently. Like, you look at all the things that they've done on Disney Plus where they've changed lyrics to some of their songs, they've digitally removed cigarettes, things like that. I'm a hand-shot first kind of guy. So I think it's important to acknowledge it, and I would like to see more movies like this one come with a disclaimer like this, even though it would be so easy to go in and edit it to say, "What did you say, fatso," or something like that. But it would be nice to see if more movies were to put a disclaimer like that. But that's my update from Bill and Ted.
What, anyway, let me ask you guys a question about this. I mean, do you guys actually, what was this movie rated?
I'm PG.
PG, right? PG. Do you guys know, like, is there a certain limit of which, if you have a certain amount of profanity, it pushes it over into PG-13.
Two fucks. R-
really?
Two fucks, yeah. Yeah, because
two, Disney Plus, not just one.
Yeah, yeah. One, you can get away, you can skate by with one. But
and that'll get a PG?
Yep.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, Disney Plus, which apparently has Adventures in Babysitting on it, which is a Touchstone movie.
Yeah.
There is one scene where they drop two fucks, but they managed to get by with a PG rating because Adventures in Babysitting came out at a time. They weren't really sure about the PG-13 rating yet. Temple of Doom was the movie that created the PG-13 rating. And so it was still new at the time of Adventures in Babysitting. But yeah, two fucks.
Interesting. That is so interesting. Because I remember like a lot of these movies as a kid, like even if it was a Disney movie, like, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know, Flight of the Navigator or something like that. They say some bad words in there. And we just kind of like, I don't know, just kind of accepted that there would be a few of these things in there. And it's very interesting, like when you're, I don't know if either of you are writers, but when you publish something, and it, especially if it's designed for 18 and under or you know, children essentially, but the literary kind of world is really uptight about this. Like people will come up and ask you, if not the actual publishers or whatever, is there any foul language in there? I want to be able to give this to my kids. And it's always been weird to me. Like kids are hearing that stuff all over the place, probably from their own parents in many cases, or their friends, and on TV, and you know, now in video games and stuff like that. So in a book of all places, you know, to have some, you know, have a shit or a fuck or something like that. Like you're worried about that. That's what you're worried about.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I don't know. It's this weird kind of standard that we have.
And you know, shits for, are for one literature. That you can get away with more.
Yeah.
You know, asshole, damns, all that sort of stuff. You can get it's fuck is the one that's going to put it over the top.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just R-rated our show right now with the amount of times that I've said it just now. but it's also weird because we're Canadian, you're American. Like I remember this from my days at the video store. We rate things differently. Like you guys in the States are easier on violence. And we're easier on sex. So
yeah, it's more of like a European standard. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, a movie like Basic Instinct, we're going to rate higher because of the violence in it, whereas you guys will rate it higher because of the sex in it. Yeah.
Oh,
because
technical stuff there.
Yeah. It's just an interesting difference.
So, anyway, they take the fat kid's chocolate bar and they step on it and then start smacking Horace around. When the scene is interrupted by the badass Rudy, played by Ryan Lambert, who has 19 total credits between 1990 and 2009, zero. So, like, he took a 20-year hiatus somewhere in there. You can tell he's a badass because he has a leather jacket and he smokes. I guess in the bully hierarchy, the kid who smokes is at the top, but he's a kind bully. He's kind of the Dexter of bullies because he only bullies the bullies.
I was going to say he's the Robin Hood of bullies.
The Robin Hood. So he makes EJ eat the Snickers bar off the ground. And with that, it's time for another sponsorship corner. So this is another big one. Monster Squad is brought to you by Snickers, Adidas, Tide, Downy, Purex. Those were all in the laundry room, so mom really likes her laundry detergents. Sunkissed Fun Fruits, Pepsi, Burger King, Robotech, My Pet Monster, Marvel Comics, specifically Punisher and Spider-Man, Gotcha Surf Clothing, Rico Cameras, Kodak, Hostess Twinkies, probably our 10th mention of Hostess Twinkies in the films we've covered, Weetabix Cereal, Fox Photo, MasterCard, and Vision Skateboards. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. So Horace has been saved by Rudy, so he asks Sean and Patrick if Rudy can join the Monster Club. They decide to put him through a monster test. So they go from where they are in front of the creepy German guy's house to their clubhouse. A super kick-ass treehouse. I always wanted a treehouse like this when I was a kid. That's where the nostalgia of this movie comes in. Is the fact that this was the treehouse that I wanted.
It is a pretty kick-ass treehouse.
Yeah. especially one with a telescope that can see into Patrick's sister's bedroom window, which is what Rudy is doing right now. They're testing him with knowledge about what kills werewolves and vampires and stuff, or whether Frankenstein is the guy or the monster. You know, a little exposition-y, but stuff that an uninitiated kid watching their first monster movie might not know yet. Rudy has proved his worth and is granted membership into this prestigious club. I don't quite understand how the bully pyramid works here, though. Like, obviously, Horace is at the bottom of the group because even his friends call him Fat Kid. But EJ and Derek are above him, but now Rudy is hanging with Horace. Are EJ and Derek, like, shouldn't there be a bully power shift as soon as Rudy becomes friends? Or is it because he smokes, he's still the top?
Rudy is like the Wolverine of the group. He's just a lone wolf who just will come and go as he pleases.
Yeah. So now we get a scene with an airplane transporting dead bodies, and one of those is Frankenstein in a casket. Did you recognize the pilot from UHF?
No.
Oh, yeah. The one pilot, that's the guy that gets all the staples in his face in UHF.
Oh.
Dracula has stowed away on board. He gets off the plane with the box full of Frankenstein when the pilot tries to dump the cargo hatch. But Dracula doesn't kill anyone, though. Like, I'm disappointed in the bad guy at this moment. I know it's a kid's movie, but shouldn't he, like, kill off... Like, even if you don't show it, shouldn't he kill off the pilots? He just flies away. But we do get to see his awesome hearse with the skull hood ornament, and his coolness goes up again. He's overlooking the city and yells out, "Let it begin!" And lightning strikes, and for some reason we see his skull. I don't quite understand that either.
One problem I have with this movie is the backstory is not thought out enough. They put in a bunch of little things like that, or even the amulet itself, without really explaining why it's important.
Yeah.
Well, or like what, like where it came from. Why does Dracula's skull appear in the lightning?
Well, all the backstory about what the amulet is, though, like, doesn't the German guy fill us in on most of that?
Oh, yeah, he does.
Yeah, and, like, it feels like it's kind of his job in the movie to just fill us in on on all the stuff that we need to know.
I don't know if either of you guys have seen the Buckaroo Banzai and the whatever.
Yeah.
That. It's like one of these movies that's really zany, and it's clearly a B-movie. And the plot is like, you can follow it if you really think about it, but the more you kind of think about it, the less sense it actually makes. So it's probably easier just to kind of just go.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's most movies I feel like we've covered.
So at home, Mom, who is played by Mary Ellen Trainer, who, I mean, she's the mom.
Mrs. Walsh.
Yeah, you say two-bit Goonies in your synopsis there. Well, here she is right here. She's the mom from the Goonies, also from Die Hard and Lethal Weapon. She has given Sean a book that she found at a yard sale, and it's Van Helsing's diary, which I wonder how it got to the States. But it's unfortunately written in German. Sean ends up seeing his dad, Dell, played by Stephen Macht, who has 95 credits, 164 episodes of General Hospital between 2007 and 2009. He's a busy actor, a couple credits a year. Recently, he was in 6 episodes of Suits, so, you know, he knows Meghan Markle, I guess.
Like, I'm assuming he's related to Gabriel Macht, like the main guy in Suits.
Oh, okay. Maybe. Dad is in his bedroom getting dressed to go to the marriage counselor with Mom. And smoking in the house. Ah, those were the days. Dad is a cop, and he gets a phone call that he has to go downtown to investigate a missing mummy from the museum. We also find out that there's a guy at the station who is claiming to be a werewolf. This is the desperate man, played by John Grease, that Josh was talking about earlier. You said that you recognized him from a bunch of things. For me, he was the busiest actor that I've never heard of. You know, but 6 episodes of Lost, like you said, Uncle Rico and Napoleon Dynamite, Men in Black, Get Shorty. Currently, he's in a series called Dream Corp LLC, which I've never heard of. But 30 episodes in. Unfortunately, Dad leaving means that he won't be able to take Sean to the movie Groundhog Day 12, which is not that Groundhog Day. And it also means a fight between Mom and Dad because he's going to work. Clearly a very common argument, but a plot point that doesn't seem necessary to me because it never seems to get brought up much again. Maybe it just adds a certain realism to help ground the film a bit. You know, you take this monster film, but you've got a family with real problems.
Yeah.
So at the museum, there is a very bizarre good cop, bad cop questioning of the Night Watchman between Dell and his partner, Detective Sapir, who is played by Stan Shaw, who was in Harlem Nights, Snake Eyes, Daylight, Rising Sun, Fried Green Tomatoes. I'm not sure why he's being the bad cop at this moment, but the ultimate conclusion is that this mummy didn't just get up and walk away, which we immediately see that yes, it has. We also have seen the guy who is claiming to be a werewolf go crazy and start attacking the cops. He wants to be locked up, but he ends up getting shot to death instead. And he's now being transported by a coroner van with lights and a siren for some reason. Okay, we're Canadian, you're American. Do your coroner vans down there have lights on them that you know of?
I gotta be honest, I have no idea. I don't think so, though. Certainly not an emergency. I mean, they're already dead, so.
Yeah.
Exactly. Why does it have lights? Why do you need to be able to run red lights in a coroner van? It makes no sense. But he comes back to life. So there goes your theory, because he needed the lights. This guy wasn't dead yet. He turns full wolf, and he takes out the driver, and he escapes.
I have a question about the werewolf. Maybe I wasn't paying attention, but do they... Like, is there a full moon, like, all this time? Do they make reference to that?
Well, that's one thing that I was wondering. Good question. Yeah. Because this movie takes place over at least 2 days, maybe three. And he's a wolf multiple times, so you don't get 3 days of a full moon. Mm-hmm. Like, shouldn't a werewolf only change once?
Yeah, that's generally how, that's the basic story, like the Universal Monsters story would be that way.
Yeah. I mean, last week we talked about Twilight, and you admitted that you've seen all the Twilight movies. So were those wolves able to change outside of a full moon?
They were, yeah. They were, actually.
So this could be like a hybrid of classic werewolf story and what they did in Twilight with...
Yeah,
with
I think if werewolves. I remember... Oh, I hate that I even know this. If I remember correctly, I think in Twilight, the werewolves like have their first change at the first full moon, like after like a certain age or whatever, after they get infected. But they're also like weird, they have like some sort of like indigenous spirituality as well that I think allows them to change like basically at will, it seems.
Yeah, okay.
So
I mean, we can't really think of Twilight as the authority for vampire and werewolf lore, but you know, I figured I'd ask. And so now Sean is sitting on his roof watching Groundhog Day 12 with his binoculars and his portable radio because it's at a nearby drive-in theater. And Dad comes home with a Burger King, sits down next to him and says, "What did I miss?" So, you know, good thing that he's dealing with walking out on his wife. We briefly see that Detective Sapir is on the scene from the wrecked coroner van site, talking about how this is now the second missing body tonight. But Wolfman, played by Carl Thibault, not John Grease, in what looks like the most uncomfortable costume ever to wear. I remember in The Dark Knight, when Bruce Wayne goes to Lucius Fox and wants a new bat suit because he wants to be able to turn his head, this wolf does not look like he could turn his head.
No.
He would not be able to back the Batmobile out of the driveway. Because that is like that upper bit, it does not look like there is any flexibility to it at all. Like this is the most uncomfortable looking werewolf ever. Definitely not sleek and scary. The Wolfman and the mummy played by Michael Reed McKay, who is 22 credits. several of which his character name has skinny as an adjective. He was also Bane pre-transformation in Batman and Robin. They have found Dracula in a swamp. At this point, about a half hour in, I got curious about where this movie is set, because we have a swamp, and soon we'll see Dracula in his big old plantation house. We're supposed to be in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Why does no one have an accent?
They had no time for that kind of continuity stuff in the 80s.
Is that really where it's supposed to take place?
It's supposed to be Baton Rouge, really? Louisiana, yeah.
So there was, I don't know if this is related at all, and I haven't seen this movie, but there was like a movie from like, I think it was like 1943, it's the Son of Dracula, I think, okay. Which takes place in, I think, Louisiana. I'm not sure. It may be New Orleans, but...
So it's possible that this is like Superman Returns, where they do a callback to something that actually existed in other movies and tried to connect it.
Well, there's so much of that. There's like so many weird references, like the name on the plane, the Shadowbrook place on the map, that are all like references to stuff in the Universal Monsters movies that most people just probably would not know.
Oh, so okay, so I need to brush up on my like 1930s, 1940s yeah. Universal Monsters. It's also kind of fortunate that the pilot happened to dump him right here. You know, where all the other monsters are conveniently located, and he has a house and the amulet. Like, it doesn't seem like that was Dracula's plan. When he was on the plane, he was like sensuously rubbing the coffin with Frankenstein in it, and it was just because the pilot dumped the cargo that he happened to end up in Louisiana. So just kind of coincidental that this is where Dracula ended up wanting to be. So Dracula summons Gillman. I guess they didn't have the rights to Creature of the Black Lagoon. And he's played by Tom Woodruff Jr. And it's been a while, but I think it's time for a Bit Player Spotlight. So Tom Woodruff Jr. was born January 21st, 1959 in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. So Josh, you're an American boy, you're in the Pennsylvania area. Do you know Williamsport?
I do, yeah. It's actually not that far from where I live. The Little League Hall of Fame is there, which is main claim to fame.
Okay. In the late 70s, early 80s, he attended Lycoming College in Pennsylvania. Do you know that college?
I do, yeah.
Okay. Earning a dual degree in business administration and theater. As an actor, he has made a career out of playing creatures kind of like Doug Jones or Andy Serkis. He has played a wolfman, devils, demons, mutants, a bull, a lion, a crocodile, and 10 times he has played a gorilla. Like in Zookeeper and Harry's Law and other TV shows. Yeah, he's been a gorilla 10 times. Plus in the movie Evolution, he played lead primate creature. So I figure that's close enough to gorilla to give him an 11th. He played Pumpkinhead in the movie Pumpkinhead. He performed Goro in Mortal Kombat, something that we didn't mention back in our episode number 6 about that movie. And most famously, he has played the alien in every Alien movie since Alien 3. So you may not know the face or the name, but you've likely seen him perform. But here's where he differs from Doug Jones or Andy Serkis. Tom Woodruff Jr. is also a special effects guy. He started off working for Stan Winston and was an assistant special effects supervisor on the movie Terminator. He worked for Stan Winston Studios for most of the 80s. Working on a Frankenstein suit for the movie The Vindicator, creature effects on Aliens and Leviathan, and also for this movie worked as head monster maker for Frankenstein. In 1988, he and fellow employee Alec Gillis from Stan Winston founded effects studio Amalgamated Dynamics, which has worked on movies like Tremors, Starship Troopers, Demolition Man, Jumanji, the original, Castaway, Scary Movie, Looney Tunes Back in Action, Michael, Paul Blart, Mall Cop, Grown Ups, The Santa Claus Movie, movies that where they need realistic animatronic animals. In 1993, he and his team won an Oscar for Best Visual Effects against Batman Returns and Alien 3. And it should be noted that he was also on the team for Alien 3. So he had a 66% chance of winning that one. So yeah, Alien 3, where he basically designed his own costume for the movie. Most recently, you'll have seen his work in the newer Godzilla movies, Jurassic Park, and of course, Pennywise the Clown in It. Yes. Maybe Tom Woodruff Jr. is a well-known name for our listeners, but for me, he's the most famous person I've never heard of.
He never made it into a Planet of the Apes movie?
No. See, that's Andy Serkis territory. Mm. No, he's big on like practical effects.
Okay.
So yeah, anytime that someone like, you know, like the Kevin James classic Zookeeper, anytime you need to interact with a gorilla, that's where he steps in. But that has been Bit Player Spotlight. So Gilman really gets the raw deal in this movie. He's so underused and so easily killed. But here Gilman comes out of the water carrying Frankenstein's casket. Dracula zaps Frankenstein with electricity and says, "Wake up, old friend. It is our time." And now we get Mom putting Sean's little sister Phoebe, played by Ashley Bank, to bed with a candle to keep her safe. A candle? Come on. She's 5 years
Not
old.
Not safe. Yeah.
Not safe at all. I would never give my 5-year-old a candle. Sean has told his sister that during lightning, monsters come out, so she's afraid of that too. And after making Mom say goodnight to her puppy Scraps, she asks, "Are you going to yell at him?" And Mom says, "Honey, I love your father." "What? No, I mean Sean for scaring me." Which makes me wonder, like, did the principal ever call the parents? Like, I'm just wondering why Sean hasn't already gotten in trouble for going to the principal's office. That should have been an automatic call home.
I feel like that because it's the ridiculousness of he's mad that they drew monster pictures. I don't know if I think that's an issue with the principal, not like all adults in the 80s.
I suppose so. Yeah, I guess if my parents got that phone call, they would just laugh about it.
They're just like, "Oh, well, I'm glad has an artistic outlet."
So the parents are fighting, and while they are, Sean notices a phone message for him. Where was he that he wasn't able to take this phone call? Was that while he was out on the roof watching a movie or something? Like, since he received the diary, he hasn't left the house. I don't know. This phone message is from Mr. Alucard regarding the Van Halen diary. Possible $$$$ sign. And suspicious Sean, for some reason, decides to rearrange the letters in the name to discover it was just an anagram for Dracula. Well, not so much an anagram as just backwards. And so now we're at Eugene's house. Eugene is the "who are you" member of the squad? Like, I don't even understand how Eugene fits in here. Is he Patrick's like five or brother something? Or...
Well, it's like a little, yeah.
Yeah, he seems older than the sister, but I don't even understand.
Not much, right?
Yeah, I don't understand why he fits into this. Like,
because somebody needed to be there at the end.
I guess so.
He's just that one player that they were like, "Oh, this will fix the story."
I figured it was like, you know, a bunch of kids in the neighborhood and they're all kind of playing together and they kind of vaguely have, you know, they've grown up together, and so they're slightly varying ages. I figured it was probably one of those scenarios where there's a couple kids that are a little older, a couple that are younger, and they kind of tag along and the other ones kind of like tolerate them.
Quite possibly. Eugene is played by Michael Faustino, who has 17 credits, Blank Check, Suburban Commando, nothing since 1995, where he is waking up his dad because there are monsters in his room. Dad humors him and announces for the monsters to get out and checks under his bed. And Eugene says it's in the closet, and Dad sarcastically checks without actually looking in the closet. And we see that the mummy is in there. Now, if this wasn't a kid's movie, they'd be straight up murdered at this point. The whole family would be dead. But instead, the mummy just leaves without incident.
And I do have to point out that little kid was wearing a Robotech shirt. It said Robotech Odyssey, which I have never actually seen. Mm-hmm. I meant to look it up actually, and I tried to find it, but I couldn't find that exact one.
Yeah.
But it was for the first season of Robotech. It was a picture of that, and so I thought I was like very happy to see that in there. Yeah. Totally dates it.
Well, that's what brought Robotech into the sponsorship corner there.
There you go. Yeah.
I would also like to note that Eugene is wearing a Confederate soldier hat. So that... So as cool as the Robotech shirt is, the Confederate soldier hat kind of knocks down that coolness a little bit.
So that makes sense, though. If it's in it was supposed to take place in Louisiana, it would make sense.
And then, I guess yeah. so. And... And
yeah, I was wondering why he was wearing that
same
hat.
Negativity in the 80s that it does now. But so later that night, there is a meeting of the Monster Squad. So yeah, Eugene is there, even though he was already in bed and had to wake up his dad. Like, this is like a midnight meeting of the Monster Club. I guess he snuck out to tell them that the mummy was in his house. Horace is, of course, in his 80s fat kid uniform of a Hawaiian shirt. And, you know, we get lines like fat kid farted, you know, such love between the squad. And the squad is onto the fact that monsters are here and vow to do something about it. All hands in, including the dog, where Rudy has one of the best lines of the movie. How's that dog get up here anyway? Because I had the exact same question, Rudy. Who is responsible for hauling this dog up the ladder every time they go into the treehouse? So we see Dracula in his plantation home with the secret dungeon, which is kind of a bonkers concept. But if you're right about this being some sort of tie-in to Son of Dracula, maybe. But, I mean, were there dungeons in Plantation House? Maybe for a more sinister reason? Like, plantation houses actually have these hidden dungeons? I don't know. But he visits a locked up Frankenstein and says, old friend, how do you like your new home? So this is how you treat your friends. Okay. He sends Frankenstein on the task of finding Van Helsing's diary and tells him to kill the kids if they don't cooperate. The squad decides the next day that they have to talk to the old scary German guy to get the diary translated. I like his introduction to in this movie where they say, okay, how do you say in German, please don't kill us? And then he comes up right behind them.
I find it weird that they make zero effort to humanize the German guy other than by showing his like
Auschwitz tattoo. Yeah.
But like his literal name in the credits is Scary German Guy. Like yeah. You couldn't give him a name like
yeah,
Walter.
Couldn't find out he was Hans.
Who's he supposed to be? I feel like I missed something when I watched the movie. Is he supposed to be somebody? I had the vague idea that maybe he was supposed to be like Van Helsing or something
yeah,
like that.
That would have made sense.
Yeah, you know, see, one of these things.
Like,
the thing.
Who is he like? Is he just like a random dude?
Yeah, as far as I can tell, he's just a random dude.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, he's just that one weirdo in the neighborhood that watches everybody and everyone, you know. Everyone makes up urban legends about him, but absolutely
it would have added to the story even if he wasn't Van Helsing, but if he was just somebody who was there
or a descendant
and like yeah. actually knew what the journal was other than just being able to read it.
Yeah. So it turns out that the scary German guy is actually a really nice guy who shares a fondness for monsters and pie. He tells them that I do like that cut too, where he goes, oh, you kids are going to pay or whatever. And then he like cuts another slice of pie. But yeah, he tells them that when he's reading from the book that every 100 years at the stroke of midnight, the amulet is vulnerable and can be shattered. And the 100-year anniversary is tomorrow. And the other option is to open the vortex using the amulet and banishing the monsters to hell. You know, the opening of the movie. And of course, we get the line from Horace, you know, gee, mister, you know a lot about monsters. And he says, now that you mention it, I suppose I do. And that's where we see the Auschwitz tattoo, which for me as a 10-year-old would have made absolutely no sense to me. But it is one of those little things that now that I'm an adult and I understand it a bit more, that like I kind of appreciate this like subtle nod that they put in there of, oh, okay, other kinds of monsters do exist. Now shit has gotten real and they need to prepare for the inevitable battle. They need to find a virgin. And so Rudy, do you know any virgins? With the spit take. And so they want Rudy to forge some silver bullets, and they need to get a map, which Fat Kid is going to do. Meanwhile, Frankenstein finds little Phoebe, and she decides to show Frankenstein to her brother Sean by saying, "Don't be a chicken shit." She asks, "Now can I be in the monster squad?" And we get some hanging with Frankenstein in the treehouse, where he's learning words like bogus and wuss, and accidentally snaps a photo of Patrick's sister changing because the telescope wasn't a big enough invasion of privacy.
Does he say, like, when he's, like, taking the picture, he's like, "Focus"? He's like, it's like he's scolding himself. I couldn't quite understand.
No, that's when he says bogus.
Oh, yeah, bogus.
The click of the camera scares him, and he, bogus, bogus.
Oh, I thought he was saying like focus, like on what you're supposed to do. It's like Dracula. I thought it was like Dracula was kind of scolding him. It's like, "Yeah, focus," like, you know.
Yeah, that would have almost been funnier, but I think I'm pretty sure it was bogus. And he has a bit of an emotional moment at the sight of a Frankenstein mask as well. Meanwhile, at Dracula's house, Wolfman is still a wolf for some reason, even though I think it's daytime at this point. But he has found the amulet hidden behind a brick wall. How is it there? Like, everyone that went to storm the castle in the beginning got sucked into the vortex, did they not?
Yeah.
So why is this amulet now suddenly in Louisiana?
Yeah, because they're not the same location. I assume the stuff at the beginning was in London or something.
Transylvania.
In Transylvania.
Transylvania. But yeah, now all of a sudden it's in Louisiana. It's surrounded by garlic and crosses, so someone knows what it was when they hid it there. But they hid it in Dracula's house? Or, like, yeah, this house makes no sense to me.
I wonder if this is, like, a reference to that other movie. So the son of Dracula, I think his name in that movie was Alucard. And so I wonder if there's, like, a backstory that we're kind of, like, missing because we haven't seen that. Because I feel like there's a lot of, like, little references. If you were, like, a scholar of those films, you might they might have stuck in there.
We'll see. Now, 2 weeks in a row, my vampire knowledge has failed me.
Well, I mean, that's just a theory. It could be just screenwriting.
Which is highly more likely.
So we go back to the kids for a getting through school montage. I don't understand the school week timeline, because they had the school day where Rudy rescues Horace, and that day ended with the nighttime meeting, and the next day they go to old German guy's house, but they don't go to school, because that's when they find Frankenstein, and they go for a sunset walk with Frankenstein at the end of the day, and then now we're back in school. So was it an abbreviated weekend, or did they just not show school for the day after? Like, did they talk to the German guy before school, or was this after? The timeline doesn't make sense. So in this montage day, Rudy is stuck doing all the stuff that could get him expelled, like melting down Sean's mom's silver to make bullets and making wooden stakes in shop class and stealing a bow and arrows from an archery class. Is their phys ed just happen to do archery at this time, or is there like an actual archery class? And he's also sent to develop naked pictures of a girl, and the whole time Phoebe is entertaining Frankenstein in the treehouse, Eugene writes to the army, and Sean is making business cards, you know, the essentials. We are now back with Dracula, who has a closet full of women. Wolfman is no longer a wolf and is drugged and tied up in the living room, but he escapes while Dracula is busy with the aforementioned women. We get the cops, Dell and Detective Sapir, talking about a hearse with no plates, and Detective Sapir says, "Ask me about the hood ornament." And Dad says, "What about the hood ornament?" "Well, I thought you'd never ask." So at this point, though, is when Wolfman phones the police and tries to warn them about the goings-on at 666 Shadowbrook Road. I don't know if that could be any more obvious. Before he turns back into a werewolf and says he's going to kill your son. So now the squad abducts Patrick's sister, who is played by Lisa Fuller, who has 29 credits, nothing since 2008, 4 episodes of The Fresh Prince. She ends up interrogated by the squad about the status of her virginity by delicately asking if she's ever been dorked. And it totally makes me think of Mallrats, where they're talking about the things dork. And he's using the nude photo of her as blackmail to get her to cooperate. Like, this is the innocence of 1987. You know, in 2020, this is child pornography. Unless she is over 18. But this is still illegal. This is still, you know, like, completely invasive. And you know, nowadays you get arrested. But not in 1987. And it's not like it was even a scandalous picture to blackmail her with. It's not like it was a picture of, like, her blowing one of her teachers or something. Like, this was her changing in her bedroom, and she just had the unfortunate luck of having Frankenstein snap a photo. It wasn't even them that snapped the photo. He just happened to stumble across it when he developed the pictures, which makes me wonder, why was he developing the pictures in the first place? He didn't know this was on there. Makes no sense!
Wasn't that after that there was like a song and it was like a montage of all those things, like where the little kid is running to the army and then
the guy, in the montage he's developing the pictures.
Yeah. And at the end it ends with like Frankenstein's holding up the photo and like he's like, you know, cheering and all the kids are like, you know,
well, yeah, because when Rudy comes out of the photo developing
pure innocence.
Yeah, the developing store, he's flipping through the pictures and he happens to find it then.
Yeah, yeah.
But he didn't know it was on there. So what was the point of developing these? You know, okay, Rudy, we need you to make some bullets. We need you to make some dangerous sharp stakes, steal a bow and arrow. And while you're out, can you develop these pictures and, you know, pick up my dry cleaning? Now Rudy's just running errands.
Part of his initiation.
Yeah. Even though he's the most badass of all of them because he smokes. So the squad heads to Dracula's mansion, led by Frankenstein. Dracula is in the dungeon with dynamite to blow open the wall to get at the amulet. The dynamite goes off, and upstairs, Frankenstein is crushed by falling debris. Really, the amount of dynamite that he put in that hole should have done much more damage than it did. Like, he's lucky the whole dungeon didn't collapse on him.
Why did he need dynamite anyway? Didn't he, like, the first thing he did, like a couple scenes back, he, like, managed to just break through the wall with a hammer. Don't like vampires have like super strength or something like that? Why didn't he just rip the wall out? Like, why did he need dynamite?
Yeah.
Where did he get the dynamite?
Well, exactly. Yeah. It does seem, I guess he was just tired at that point. Oh boy. I spent all day knocking these four bricks out. Good thing I've got this dynamite to finish the job. I mean, really, in theory, like, if it wasn't for all the crosses and garlic inside, he could just shrink down to a bat and go through the hole himself. Yeah.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, and he's with creatures like the Gillman and Frankenstein, who both also have superhuman strength. So any of them could have ripped open the wall, too. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. The dynamite, I don't know. So yeah, Frankenstein upstairs is crushed by the falling debris, and at this point, all hell breaks loose because everyone seems to instinctively know that there are intruders in the house. The three women from the closet are now vampire brides. The Wolfman is back, and of course, Dracula himself. And they're surrounded, and they all yell at Horus to kick Wolfman in the nards, and apparently, Wolfman has nards. One of the most famous lines from this movie. I mean, obviously, it's enough to name a documentary with that title. Sean manages to find a secret lever a la Scooby-Doo, or I guess as his example is, the Hardy Boys. And they end up in the dungeon facing skeletons and the amulet, which is surrounded by garlic and crosses. And even though Dracula used the dynamite on this hole, it's still not a very big hole that he's created. Like, the power of this dynamite is very selective. But Dracula catches up because, really, they had practically no head start on him, and they've been dawdling, but Sean has the amulet. Dracula tries to take it from him, but with quick thinking, Horace pulls a slice of pizza out of his pocket, as one does, and presses it against Dracula's face, burning him with garlic. And just like last week with the Lost Boys, I asked, how much garlic did they put on their pizzas in 1987?
clearly a lot, because it's now becoming a popular usage against vampires.
Popular way to dispense of vampires. So they get the fuck out of there without encountering any more monsters somehow, and discover that the scary old German man with Phoebe, nice that mom is letting 5-year-old Phoebe go off with the weird stranger down the street, and the other half of the squad on their bikes has somehow found them, and so they get into the old German guy's Jeep to drive off, and their plan is to head to the church in town square because monsters hate religious stuff. And as they're driving, they come across the mummy, who grabs onto the back. Rudy ties one of the loose straps of bandage from the mummy to one of the stolen arrows, shoots it into a tree, and they drive past, and mummy unravels, leaving just a skull. And Rudy says, "See you later, Band-Aid breath." Oh man, that Rudy, he's so badass.
There was a line. Rudy has a lot of great lines, but there's, I think this is the main kid's line. It was right before the mummy came off, and he literally says this, and I don't actually know what it means, but it's awesome. He says, "We pull this off, I'm just gonna shit."
Yep. Yeah, well, okay.
You gotta do what you gotta do, you know.
Make sure you're stocked on toilet paper. Have fun with that.
Yeah, I mean, where are you gonna do it? You're just gonna do it right there on the floor, right in the middle of the room.
right on Dracula.
Right on Dracula. Yeah, that's yeah. So Dracula is chasing after them in his hearse, and the cops are driving towards his house, and they end up driving through his car for some reason before actually catching up with them as well in town square. He takes the time to stop at their treehouse to blow it up with the line, "Meeting adjourned." And Del and Detective Sapir have followed, and Dracula has one stick of dynamite left, and he blows up the cop car with Detective Sapir inside. So even in a kid's horror movie, the black guy is the first official death, a trope that was made fun of in Scream and has started to get rectified in a post-Get Out world, but kind of interesting that there's only one real death in this movie. And it's the person of color. That's welcome to the 80s, boys.
Why'd they have to do that?
Yep. Well, like I said, at least it's something that they're fixing now that Jordan Peele is directing horror movies. It's going to be interesting to see that new Saw movie with Chris Rock as well. That's going to be an interesting one. So the squad is in town square, and they are getting Patrick's sister to read from the diary. Her high school German is failing her, but old scary German guy is there to help her with the pronunciation. The monsters have all congregated. Patrick's sister is still trying to read from the diary, and Rudy takes off to try to dispose of the three women vampires. You know, "Rudy, where are you going?" "I'm in the goddamn club, aren't I?" Boom! Rudy sticks them with another one. And so he just stakes them all to death. Cop dad to the rescue, because Dracula is coming in bat form, and dad, while he's driving, manages to take out Dracula. And he crashes through the window of a nearby sporting goods store, and they find him in the attic of this store, half transformed. And dad lights a stick of dynamite. Where did he get that one from? Like, everyone is just carrying around dynamite in this movie. Like, why is this something that was on cop belts in 1987? Radio here, gun here, handcuffs, and a stick of dynamite, just in case.
You never know when he'll need it.
Just for the extreme situations. Yeah, so he grabs the dynamite, he lights it to dispose of him. "Suck on this, you son of a bitch." And then Wolfman bursts in. And he and Wolfman and Dad struggle, and then Sean bursts in and says, "Hey, asshole," and hits him with a baseball bat. And Dad stuffs the dynamite into Wolfman's pants and pushes him out the window with the lit dynamite, and Wolfman explodes. But it turns out that he isn't dead yet. But boy, for dynamite, like, this movie has taught me that dynamite is a precision instrument. In the basement of Dracula's house, it's made that hole a couple feet bigger. You know, with this, even though it was stuffed in the waistband of Wolfman's pants, his torso is completely intact, but his arms and head are blown off. So, or is that maybe the head still attached?
No, he's blown up like above the abdomen. So his like chest, his chest part is off, and then it all gets sucked back.
But yeah, much like the T-1000 in Terminator 2, all the pieces managed to fit themselves back together, and I just would have thought that the pieces would have been much tinier with a stick of dynamite in your belt. Meanwhile, Patrick's sister has gotten to the end of the diary, and nothing has happened. Turns out she wasn't a virgin. Well, Steve, but he doesn't count, is what she says. I kind of want to know what she did with Steve. Well, Steve and I did anal, so that doesn't count. I feel like that's the word that's missing from this. It wasn't regular sex.
Wait, who is Steve? Is that like her boyfriend?
Or well,
is
yeah, that... I'm wondering whether that's like, the guy Steve? When Rudy that... was spying on her. I'm wondering whether Steve was the guy that dropped her off in his car there. Maybe.
Like, what does it not count? Is this like your dad or your brother or some crazy shit like that? I mean, why would that not count? How does it not count? No,
Steve, well, Steve, he doesn't count. He's my cousin.
Who
is, yeah, Louisiana. Right.
Who is Steve anyway?
So more cops show up, but they're useless. Seems like their only purpose is to get beat up and help Rudy steal a cop gun and put the silver bullets he made in it. He takes out the new resurrected werewolf while the werewolf is attacking the cops. And then Gilman pops out of the sewer, and Horace has gotten his hands on his shotgun and uses it to blow him away while the bullies from the beginning cower in the store behind him. And then they say, "Hey, fat kid, good job." And then he says, "My name is Horace." And he shook, shook, cocks the shotgun. So now Horace has gotten to the top of the bully pyramid. But they need a new virgin. So they choose little Phoebe. Now, did I miss something that specified that the virgin has to be female? Because
yeah,
frankly,
like any of the kids, like,
frankly, I assume that every one of those boys is a virgin. So why get the 5-year old that has a lisp to read this passage from the diary?
I don't know. It's always a girl.
maybe we should point out the fact that boys can be virgins too. Because they even said, why not just get the old German guy to read it? And they go, well, he's not a virgin.
I think it probably is like a, what do you call it? Like one of those like puritanical tropes where it's like, no men are just constantly like impure. Like they're just born impure. But like the virgin woman is the purest of all.
Oh, okay.
It's like a unicorn thing, right?
You need,
yeah. You need a, isn't that the thing? Like you need a virgin female, right?
Yeah,
to attract a unicorn.
I mean, it's a thing that appears regularly, even in like Greek mythology, like oracles and all that. There's a whole thing, like even in Greek history, even though it's not real, but like oracles were supposed to be virgin girls because the belief was if they had sex, they would lose their ability to see into the future and that kind of stuff.
And even with your point at unicorns, I know that in Harry Potter. When Professor Grubbly Plank takes over the class for Hagrid, she shows the kids unicorns, and he tells the boys to stay back because they're not as skittish around girls. So I think you have a point there with that. But it just seems a little bonkers that they're putting all their eggs in Phoebe's basket here.
Well, so the thing too is usually it's like it's supposed to be a woman who's like of age. That's what makes it more important. So it's interesting, if it could have just been any virgin, why didn't they just go to Phoebe from the beginning? Why even go through all the trouble of developing the photos to blackmail the sister?
Yeah, because the girl in the beginning that is their virgin in Transylvania, she looks very much the same age as Patrick's sister. And much like German guy, I want to point out that Patrick's sister's character name is actually Patrick's sister. So they didn't bother giving her a name either. So Dracula, who is not dead, comes at Phoebe and picks her up by the chin, ouch, and tells her, "Give me the amulet, you bitch." But Frankenstein saves Phoebe. She finishes the passage, the portal opens, Dracula makes one last attempt to get Sean, and Sean stakes him in the heart, and then Van Helsing comes out of the portal to help wrestle Dracula into oblivion, and gives him a thumbs up. So this vortex, which has like the power to suck in all the, everything around it, you know, somehow Van Helsing can come out far enough to help pull Dracula in.
And but also, like, the conceit of that is that now Van Helsing and Dracula are mortal enemies, and now they're just going to be stuck in this limbo world together, presumably unable to kill one another.
It's like they're stuck in the Phantom Zone from Superman, and yeah, they're just stuck for eternity with their face pressed against the glass next to each other, but they hate each other. Yeah. So, unfortunately, Frankenstein gets sucked into poor Phoebe, and you know, I have to say that, like, I legitimately got a little choked up. Like, that little Phoebe was pretty good in this scene. Like, the Frankenstein leaving, I really didn't want Frankenstein to go. I wanted him to be kind of like Sloth and Goonies. I wanted them to make space for him at home for the, yeah, you know, to move.
I rewound that scene. I watched it like two or three times, that particular one, because it was they had the whole music. Frankenstein gets like the, or Frankenstein's monster, I should say. I don't know. It seems odd calling him Frankenstein's monster. He's not really a monster.
Yeah.
But Frank.
Yeah, I've been referring to him as Frankenstein the whole time.
Yeah. He gets the teddy bear. Like, Phoebe throws him her stuffed animal. He's a teddy bear or something like that. And he kind of does the waving goodbye and everything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, legitimately missed it up a little bit at that scene. Like, it really was kind of a heartbreaking scene. For all the cheesiness and grief that I've given the rest of the movie, it's like, this moment was actually, you know, like, 1 minute worth of, like, real feels, you know? It is also kind of interesting that this vortex is strong enough to suck up the German guy's car, but Phoebe is safe behind a bench that's 15 feet further back. And things are flying over her head, like pieces of fence are flying over her head, but she's fine. This bench is not going anywhere. This bench, this is where it's at. This is, if there's a tornado in Oklahoma, it's under this bench is where you're going to want to be, because you're going to be safe.
The logic of who and what gets sucked up makes no sense. Clearly large metal poles are not safe, but like, Sean is riding Dracula into the portal at one point, and then he stakes him, and he is just able to stand up while Dracula continues to be pulled, and he just stands there and is fine. So I was wondering if there was something to do with, like,
pure soul.
Do you have, like, the will of the amulet? Like, the amulet just knows, like, monsters. Get monsters and any inanimate objects.
But all the good guys got sucked up in the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. So, that makes sense.
So, just in time to do absolutely nothing, the army that Eugene had written a letter to earlier shows up. I don't quite understand what the whole point of this army storyline was. Except for this line, where the army guy asks, "Who are you?" "We're the Monster Squad." And thank God Sean printed those business cards earlier so that he had a business card to flip to this army guy. And Sean's parents are reunited with the kids, and boom, credits. Monster Squad over. And that is the Monster Squad. So, Colin, Josh, on IMDb, it scored a 7.1 out of 10. It has a Metascore of 61. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 62% on the tomato meter from the critics and an audience rating of 78%. But as usual, those are just numbers. What do people have to say about this movie, Colin?
All right. So for this week, Monster Squad, I'm going to the critics on Rotten Tomatoes here. And to be honest, I was shocked at how many people love this movie.
It's the nostalgia factor.
It's
that's why we're here, to look past that.
Crazy to me. Absolutely crazy. So Nathan Raven from the AV Club says, "Squad's gleeful monster mash anticipates bloated CGI orgies like Van Helsing, Hugh Jackman classic, which likely cost 100 times as much, yet boasts 1/100th of the squad's scrappy ramshackle charm."
Awesome.
Vincent Crosby from the New York Times takes a more negative slant. He says, "A silly attempt to crossbreed an R-gang comedy," which I didn't know that our gang was a genre, but after watching all these 80 movies, I guess if that's what you want to call it, it works for me.
Our gang.
Okay, yeah.
Like the Little Rascals, like those. Yeah. Okay.
So a silly attempt to crossbreed an Our Gang comedy with a classic horror film, which usually means that both genres have reached the end of the line. And then Hal Hinson from the Washington Post says the movie plays like it was written with a power tool, which I could not agree with more, because it's just things are just slotted in just to help, just to move things along, just to like fill in these glaring holes.
Well, I think I want to modify that one. I don't think it was written with a power tool. I think it was written with a stick of dynamite. Yeah.
This definitely must have been one of Shane Black's like early works, because I do appreciate a lot of his other movies.
Yeah. Well, there we go. That's the critics. So, like I said, we got low 70s. Oh, except that 78 is a bit of an anomaly. Critics are around 60. And audiences are 71 to 78. Where does this fall for you, Josh? You're our special guest. You said you enjoyed this movie. I mean, it's cheesy, it's fun, but where can you legitimately say that this falls for you if you had to rate it?
I actually, you know, I think it's, I will qualify it by saying, like, if you want like a traditional horror movie, if that's what you're in the mood for, I think you'll be disappointed by the movie. It's kind of like if you want a Western and there's a mix up at the video store, if those still exist, and you get Blazing Saddles or something like that. So like, I mean, I think you have to be in the movie for something that's really campy and like really sort of B movie-esque. And I've never seen the movie before, so like there's no real nostalgia for the actual film. But like, I think there's nostalgia for other stuff like that. So I don't know. I had a good time. The way I typically, because I have like little kids, and I really don't have a chance to like watch much of anything at this point. So the only time I really get a chance to like watch something, I have a, like basically a computer in front of a treadmill, and then I'll watch the films when I'm like running.
Okay.
And so it kept my attention. I didn't fall off the treadmill. There was a couple of times where I had to pause it because I was laughing, or like, you know, because otherwise I might like fall off the back of the treadmill. So I don't know. I'd probably give it an 8. You know, 8 out of 10.
Okay. Okay. That's impressive. I mean, I know it's very much like a kid's movie, but it's not one that I would show my kids. So like, it treads this line of something that I can understand the appeal of it being a kid's movie, but yeah, I wouldn't want a kid to see this. I've got a 7-year-old and an 8-year-old, you know, like maybe when they're in double digits, I'll let them watch it. Colin, your first time watching it. Oh boy, you're the foreshadowing from your beginning 60-second synopsis, buddy. What have you got for us? You're gonna dump on this hard, aren't you? This is gonna be. If we make it through this, I'm gonna shit, right? Is that what this is? This is you taking a big old dump over Monster Squad, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if like in the movie it sounds like shitting is a positive thing, so I'm not gonna shit on. I am going to shit on this movie, but I'm not gonna shit. I'd give this movie a giant. It was the worst movie I've seen in a long time, and I watched Cats the movie this weekend. So.
Wow, so you even hate this more than UHF. Like, you dumped on UHF. You gave one a 10.
I would watch UHF like 10 times before I watched this movie again. I just thought it was, I don't know. Again, there was really no draw to it for me. And the thing is, I actually like the Universal Monsters. I love vampires, especially like we talked in The Lost Boys and that kind of stuff, but they're all just done not great. Like Frankenstein is okay, but the rest are all just kind of like blah to me.
They're wimpy.
And I found just the story lacked something. It went by so fast, but they didn't take enough time to like really set up a lot that I wanted to see, which I mean is very, that happens a lot in 80s movies, I've noticed. There was, one thing I found like really crazy though was I, just in like looking up some fun facts about this movie was, so I love vampires, like I said, and I like Dracula, and I, watching this movie, I just thought this Dracula was the worst. I thought it was one of the absolute worst Draculas I've ever seen, but In 2006, Wizard Magazine made a list of the 100 greatest villains of all time. Dracula is ranked number 30 on the list, and they referenced this performance.
Really?
They said that Duncan Regeer's performance in this film was, like, better than any other Dracula performance, including Bela Lugosi, which is insane.
Wow.
But yeah, oh, I don't know. This movie just, it didn't do it for me.
Well, I mean, you say it flew by pretty fast. You may have noticed that this is one of those movies that didn't even achieve a 90-minute runtime.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for me, I can't go as high as 80. With a good conscience, I can't go as high as 80. I can stick around where the critics are with this. I'm happy with a good solid 60. It's another one where I just can't completely eliminate my nostalgia for it. And it really, like I said at the beginning, this is the gateway drug into horror movies. I mean, this is a good first horror movie for kids that are a few years older than my kids are right now.
Yeah.
So there we go. That's the Monster Squad, and that's our show for this week. A big special thank you to our spooky guest, Josh Blum.
Yeah, thanks, Josh.
Yeah, Josh.
Thank you for having me.
Time for a little self-promotion, man. Where can people find you on the interwebs? Tell us all about you.
Yeah, so I'm a writer and a musician, and you can find all that stuff on my website, which is 13thhr.wordpress.com. Or if you look up me on social media, like Instagram, if you just Google my name, or like not Google, if you use the search engine there, you'll be able to find me. The handle is THE13THHR.OST for the podcast. It's the 13th Hour Podcast on like iTunes or Stitcher, or all those kind of places like that.
Yeah, we've got one of those handles on Twitter where you have to spell it out a little bit. But yeah, 13th Hour Podcast. So think abbreviations, HR dot, yeah, so 13th Hour with...
Just go to Google, go to Amazon. You can find all this stuff on Amazon if you look under 13th Hour on Amazon.
Your book, I looked it up. It's on Goodreads. It's on Kindle. It's on all those kind of sites. So you can download that as well. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you
like that show... One thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to go to Apple or Spotify or whatever app you listen to your podcasts on. Give us 5 stars on the apps that allow it, like Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. We're now on Amazon Music. Yeah, it doesn't matter what you say. You could tell us that Wolfman has nards. That's all you need to tell us. It doesn't matter what you say. It's just give us those 5 stars. Help drive us up the charts. Help us get noticed.
If you want to get in contact with us, you can send us an email at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. Also, check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you'll find all the podcasts, links to all our social media. Social media is the best place to go if you want to find out what movies we're watching so that you can watch them as well and then come hear what we have to say.
We are also now on Patreon, so if you would like to donate to us, help make our show sound better, you can become part of the I Used to Like This One community at patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter and the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Thanks for listening, and join us next week when we look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.
Another one in the can.
Another one in the can.